The year 1859 witnessed many remarkable and noteworthy events. For example, Brahms' first piano concerto in D minor premiered in Hanover, Germany. The Codex Sinaiticus was discovered in Egypt. Oregon became the 33rd state in the Union. Construction of the Suez Canal was begun. And Charles Blondin became the first person to walk a tightrope across Niagara Falls. But for us today, as believers in America, perhaps the most significant event occurred on November the 24th, 1859, when a man named Charles Darwin published his research and interpretation of his field studies entitled On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Over 150 years later, Darwin's theories and what he proposed scientists would find if his theories were true have been found to be false in most instances. And this statement is not at all controversial, as most scientists state that the theories of evolution are broad enough to admit various interpretations of what is observed, and therefore, when proven false, scientists committed to Darwinian evolution simply offer another explanation. Darwin's evolutionary theories rely on naturalistic mechanisms to explain the origin of species. But can scientific materialism sufficiently explain the origin of life? The evidence strongly supports a much different origins explanation. Stay tuned for my interview with researcher, author, and theologian Dr. Thomas Woodward next on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me.
And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Thanks for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. And when you do, would you please leave us a review and a rating? Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And of course, you can listen to every episode from our webpage, www.soaringeagleradio.com. Dr. Tom E. Woodward is a research professor and chair of the theology department at Trinity College of Florida and a prominent Christian apologist. He's published widely defending intelligent design and refuting Darwin's theory of evolution. Since 1988, he has been the Florida director of Trinity College's Center for University Ministries. Dr. Woodward has also maintained an evangelical teaching and discipleship ministry and has been head of the C.S. Lewis Society, which is housed at Trinity College. He has a B.A. in history from Princeton University and a master's in theology and systematic theology from Dallas Theological Seminary. He did his doctoral work at the University of South Florida. His thesis, A History of the Intelligent Design Movement, was published by Bigger Books as Doubts About Darwin in 2003. He's the author of numerous other books, including Darwin Strikes Back, and co-authored with Dr. James Gillis, The Mysterious Epigenome, What Lies Beyond DNA, and Darwinism Under the Microscope. It is my pleasure to welcome Tom Woodward to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show. Welcome, Tom.
Well, it's great to be soaring with you and the, you know, the rest of the Soaring Eagles. Yes. It's my privilege.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I know you keep a busy, busy schedule, too. Tom, I've known you and about you for a while now, and just as a disclaimer for listeners, Tom's radio show, which we're going to touch on here in just a few moments, The Universe Next Door, is one of the popular programs on our radio station here in Lima, WTTP FM, that plays on Saturday mornings early and then also on Sunday afternoon, that I affectionately call the Sunday afternoon theology block. We have programs from about 3 through about 8 o'clock that are pretty much just theology and apologetics. And Tom, your program, The Universe Next Door, is right in the middle of that lineup. So thanks for doing that show.
Sure.
I'd like to start with you sharing your faith journey. You have a very interesting background and how you came to faith. You were a pretty ardent evolutionist at one time.
I was. I would say I was on a scale of 1 to 10. I was somewhere between 9 and 10 as far as aggressive, you know, in a kind of like a, you know, sharing eagerly the great news. You know, I was almost an evangelist for Charles Darwin. And I grew up in a fairly straightforward religious family. By the way, not too far from Columbus, Ohio.
No. Oh.
So just down the road a bit, from where, of course, you're located.
Yes.
But the experience I had in high school was one of the science dominance of the 60s. I was in the college by 1968. My father's, my three older brothers, all of them applied to and were accepted at very elite universities, but the family tradition was to go to Princeton. And I was accepted at Yale and Princeton. I went to, made my dad eternally happy by turning down Yale and going to Princeton.
Yeah.
And so my dad thought, well, now we're in a good way. Well, I wasn't in a good way spiritually. They were going to a quasi-Presbyterian church at the time, and I was in my mind going to the great church of Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
I didn't even attend church when I went to college. I went along with my parents, of course, made them happy. As far as I was concerned, miracles couldn't happen. I mean, that was unscientific.
Yeah.
I was, of course, I'd never heard about a guy named C.S. Lewis, except I think I had read maybe a little bit of the science fiction trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard about Screwtape Letters, but he was far away from my consciousness. But I heard about students at Princeton as a freshman, October and November, that were having this Genesis study. I thought, well, that's okay. I'm, you know, I've never read Genesis, really. I've gone to church my life and never read much of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started talking about evidence for creation and evidence, scientific evidence, against Darwin's theory of natural selection, you know, evolution at a macro scale.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, this is crazy.
Yeah.
This is pure insanity. You know, at an Ivy League university, and one of the tops in the world, known for its science, especially physics, but other areas, that at Princeton somebody would be putting out hogwash like this. So I went out to one of the December meetings. They had a Bible conference and a guest speaker. I determined to meet the leader of the group and set him straight. Well, as I spent some time, was introduced to him, and by the way, he brought up the issue of falling short of moral standards, you know, the issue of sin, in a very kind of gentle but in a way bold way, within 10 minutes after meeting him. Yeah, and so I thought it almost took my breath away, but I went to his house so I could deliver my Darwin lecture, and he wound up sharing Isaiah 53, which I had never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
He shared all kinds of scripture, Old and New Testament, which I had never encountered. Well, I fought back vehemently, came back the next day for a second round of the debate, finally kind of bowed my head and muttered a prayer, which I did not mean from my heart, and scurried quickly. Like evacuating a battlefield you don't want to defend anymore.
Right.
And I went home for Christmas, and my atheist brother told me what to say to this guy, and I came back with my guns blazing and told him I didn't want to see him anymore. And he was shocked, and he said, well, I'll pray for you.
Yeah.
So this founder of the Princeton Evangelical Fellowship literally was in this process of leading me to Christ on his knees. And meanwhile, the angst, as the Germans call it, anxiety about your eternal future, whether you have anything, began to hit me like wave after wave, and young fellow down the hall, anyway, to make a long story short, was having a Bible study with a fellow much more closer to our age, in the mid-20s, and so he had come to Christ at Princeton. He began meeting with me weekly, and finally in May at his apartment, our last meeting this semester, I was at the end of my freshman year, he said, well, you know, trusting Christ, his death for your sins and his resurrection, which vanquished hell, sin, and death, is a fact that you need to trust in him personally. Like, don't just look at the chair, go over and sit on the chair.
Yeah.
The chair, of course, being analogous to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So do I have to do this here in front of you? He said, no, you can go back to your room, you do it privately, and you know, get in your closet if you have to, but just let me know as soon as you make the decision. I said, well, I'm going to do it sooner or later. I think I'll get it over with now. And put my faith in Christ very simply, leaning on him, turning to him, trusting him and him alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that perfect, instantly, an assurance. That no matter what happened, I would go be with Christ in heaven eternally. Not for any good thing I'd done, but because of what Christ had done on the cross.
Yes.
Taking my place and rising powerfully. So I was willing to suspend my, what I would call, looking back, illogical or, you know, not based in any kind of fact, my doubt of the resurrection. I was willing to suspend that doubt. But I was still confused about the issue of creation, evolution. So my first prayer, and for this I'll close my testimony, my first prayer was, Dear Lord, 10 minutes after receiving Christ, Dear Lord, I pray I won't have to get involved with this Princeton Evangelical Fellowship. You're all a bunch of creationists, Lord, and you know I'm an evolutionist.
Yeah.
I can imagine God booming out a hearty laugh and saying, permission denied.
Right.
So and within 2 or 3 days, I did make up with Dr. Fullerton, the 78-year-old founder of the group, and he discipled me and prepared my heart for the mission field, and I guess I've been a missionary ever since.
Amen.
And I got straightened out on creation within about 2 or 3 months.
Amen. Well, I want to touch on a couple of things that you mentioned there, Tom. But first of all, I guess from your perspective as a professor, an author, an apologist, you have opportunities to interact with people every day. And so my question is, in your opinion, are people becoming more open or less opening to listening to thoughtful explanation of Christianity?
Wow, that's a great question. It's kind of a tough question to answer because it really depends on where you are in the world. And, of course, speaking of the current moment of time in the U.S., because of the blaze of the guns of new atheism, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, the great, the late, and from a publishing standpoint, the late and great Christopher Hitchens, and others of that group have so besmirched and attacked and tried to smear mud all over Christianity and accusing it of all kinds of reprehensible things that it has never rightly or righteously, justly been accused. Because of that, I think that the Christian faith has been sent, at least in some quarters, into a public relations shadow. And so I think that we don't need to be overwhelmed or discouraged by that, just be at least be aware that people who have been battered or at least bamboozled, hit with this kind of propaganda, might need a little bit of a space of, well, you know, what you've rejected is probably a caricature, a false picture of Christianity, not the real thing. And so therefore, I have my students at Trinity College down here in Tampa, Florida, at our Bible college, I have the students actually read and encounter and listen to some of these guys. Richard Dawkins being, of course, the chief evangelist for atheism in the world today. And so I think that that's a tough situation. I think in a way, however, people, if they're open to science, there's an ongoing fascination with design and intelligent design in particular, I think it's stronger than it's ever been. Again, in spite of what you've heard, maybe people have heard from the press reports.
I agree with that. You mentioned earlier that you'd never heard of C.S. Lewis in your pre-Christ days. You sure know about him now, though, don't you?
Well, I better know since I run an organization named after him. We were privileged recently to spend a day with his son, stepson, but you know the son was adopted and Doug Gresham, mm-hmm. Now 70 years old, has the energy of a 20-year-old, mm-hmm. and the articulate presence of a commander-in-chief of a great nation, practically. But
yeah.
Doug Gresham, has spent now 2 days in the last several years just lecturing in our tours of the kilns and Magdalen College, the place where Lewis lived and taught at Oxford. And so reading about the 15, I think, up closer to 20 of his books, and reading about two-thirds of his life's 6,000 letters to people all over the world has given me an endearing love for the man. I can't wait to hug him in heaven. I think there's about 12 million people will be in line to give that hug.
Right.
Because I don't think I've ever met such a thoroughly Christian person, in his mind and his heart, writer in my life. And just, I may not agree with every, detail.
Sure.
Like the dotting of this I versus the dotting of that I. But I think that overall his grounding in Scripture, mm-hmm. alongside his mammoth intellect,
yes.
is just astounding. It's astonishing and it's exhilarating. Every time I step into Lewis, I'll almost have a moment of unforgettable breakthrough of realization who Christ is and how great he is.
Yes.
So it's been, I think, a hearty, almost like a surprising feast. Hearty feast every time that we get to study him, and he's the greatest as far as a single person resource for the growing Christian and apologist today. It's just fun to study him, and I teach a course on his life and writings every other year at Trinity, and it's usually packed out.
yeah, I can imagine. So, and there is a website for the C.S. Lewis Society. What is that, Tom?
So we're blessed to have apologetics.org.
Oh wow. Yeah, that's a good one to have, apologetics.org.
Yeah, we were given that by the Lord in 1995.
Wow.
We were able to grab it pretty quickly.
Yeah. Your radio show that I mentioned earlier, The Universe Next Door, is there a primary focus for that program that you try to frame the show around? Is it mostly intelligent design, or do you have guests on that speak about theology, the very broad field of apologetics, or what's the focus, Tom?
Well, the focus, broadly speaking, is apologetics with kind of an asterisk. The asterisk would be our specialty is and has been, really since our founding 27 years ago, the area of evidence for creation, evidence for the Creator.
Yes.
The problems with macroevolution. I mean, no one really doubts microevolution, depending on how it's defined. But macro, the origination of new kinds of animals or plants, and radically new, genuinely new forms of digital DNA, RNA, and protein information. That structural and, you might say, informational or digital hard drive newness is never seen in the evidence. Never even does it come close to being seen in the biological experiments or observations as coming from natural causes, blind, undirected causes, are never, and I can really say that with assurance, that there's not a slightest hint of evidence anywhere in the literature where Darwin's theory is being vindicated. If anything, Darwin's theory is like the Titanic in its last 30 minutes before it slipped underneath the waves.
Yes.
It is in such atrocious shape from one tip of the ship to the other. It isn't just one evidential iceberg. There are literally 20 to 30 evidential icebergs.
Yes.
That Darwin's Titanic has been slamming against and taking on water. Mm-hmm. If I were a Darwinist, I would really be, if you're not in the lifeboats now, take a jump into one.
Yeah.
excuse me for using the metaphor, but I'm just trying to grab, the essence of about... But really 5 to 6 years of programming where we've had scientist after scientist, expert after expert, come on and detail the problems with the Darwinian theory. But that's not the only area we cover. We do cover the whole issue of worldviews.
Yeah.
And apologetics is the explaining and defending or vindicating the Christian worldview over against major competing worldviews.
Yeah.
And so the book, The Universe Next Door, written by Jim Sire, fantastic resource on worldviews,
yes.
is the very book that inspired the name we switched to 3 years ago. The Universe Next Door is a study of worldviews and why the Christian worldview really makes sense logically and intuitively in the heart and the mind, and with comparing it with the evidence, it just, you know, passes the test really beautifully.
Yes.
And yet I'll talk about the physical universe as well. So I hope that answers your
question.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Kind of a meandering way.
And Tom, something else before we jump into the meat of this conversation, I want our listeners to be aware that there are a lot of outstanding resources available for them to really receive a crash course in intelligent design, conversation and theory and what it's actually saying. They can get up to speed in a hurry if they'll avail themselves of these resources, and those are available on your website as well, aren't they?
Yes. And if I could just say that, you know, Jonathan Wells has done such a massive, powerful job in both debunking the evidence, supposed evidence for Darwin's theory, and presenting the positive case for design. If I could put a plug in for his book, maybe.
Yes.
It's one of the books that I've used very frequently in courses on this topic. It's called The Politically Incorrect Guide. You may have seen that series of books.
Yes.
It's called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design. Fantastic resource. So if I had to recommend one book, I would recommend, even over, you know, the book two of my series, I would recommend Jonathan Wells' book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design. Very, very readable, but meaty. It's a feast. My own book, Darwin Strikes Back, Defending the Science of Intelligent Design, is similar to it. It maybe takes a slightly different tack by going into every area of the evidence and every one of the major defenders of intelligent design and exponents of the evidence for design. So Darwin Strikes Back, again, is available. And but the videos, let me just go ahead and pick off three awesome, off-the-chart videos produced by Illustra Media. And these are the videos that if you'll watch each one of them, it doesn't have to be in this sequence, but these 3 one-hour videos will give any watcher, anyone who enjoys them, a crash course on intelligent design, and really a crash course on the unraveling of the Darwinian paradigm. So here they are. Can I name them real quick?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. So if anybody wants to take a note, they are available, of course, on our website, apologetics.org, on our web store. I think several of them might be available on YouTube. So if you want to take a look at them, and they're available everywhere on the Internet for ordering. Okay, number one, unlocking. Just think of unlocking a door. Unlocking the mystery of life. It, on a scale of 5 stars, is about 12 to 15 stars.
Wow.
It is just an unbelievable... So to try to go into the realm of apologetics without watching unlocking the mystery of life is a little bit like trying to get your handle on what the Bible teaches and never reading the book of Romans.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I would say everybody should start with unlocking the mystery of life. It's only 1 hour long. And it will just give you such a fantastic, brilliant, it's fun to listen to. I've seen it probably 120 times because I keep showing it to more people. And every time I just see people at the end, they just sit there and they just say, wow. One pastor, after about 3 seconds, he said another, wow, as he was thinking of how he's going to use that film.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So Unlocking the Mystery of Life. Second one, The Privileged Planet. Like take the word privilege and add a D as in the past tense, perfect participle, privileged planet, the privileged planet. And it has the advantage of being narrated by Gimli the Dwarf, the British actor John Rhys Davies, who plays Gimli and also plays Sala, Harrison Ford's friend in Indiana Jones movie, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So John Rhys Davies does a brilliant job in describing the fine-tuning of the universe.
Yeah.
So then the third film, which came out in 2009, that completed that trilogy, is on the fossil record, and it's called Darwin's Dilemma. Darwin's Dilemma. And so those three are mandatory watching, and the same company has put out another series of films on the Case for Christ, Case for Faith, Lee Strobel's books. Also, they've done their third trilogy now, just completed it about a month and a half ago, and it covers one film on butterflies, one on birds, and the new one on wonders of the sea. Mm-hmm. Whales, salmon, sea turtles, and and dolphins.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Tom, your first book, Doubts About Darwin, A History of Intelligent Design, does a remarkable job of explaining exactly what intelligent design is saying, what scientists in the field, what researchers are saying, and so it is a history, so to speak, of that. Could you define for our listeners what intelligent design proponents are saying? What is intelligent design, and why is that important for believers especially to understand?
Thank you. I worked hard on that book. You know, of course, it was before I rewrote it for the general public. It was my doctoral dissertation.
Yes.
And so I put almost all the technical discussion in the endnotes and in a couple of the appendices. The Doubts About Darwin is really trying to get to the heart of this new kid on the block, the theory that is just now turning 30 years old.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like a plane that has been taxiing very actively, and now it's just roaring its engines and taking off because of its very rigorous scientific approach, which is not chained down. It's not fettered or shut in by philosophy.
Yes.
Like Darwinism. Darwinism decides ahead of time. Darwinism asserts that science, as part of its understanding of science, science is the study of just physical causes, you know, things that are on the order of laws of nature,
yeah,
or chance. Just given enough time and enough chance, enough matter and energy, you know, life will happen. So, and if you try to introduce the idea of a cause that is not physical but mental, that is an intelligent agent, they say, no, that's not science.
Right.
So intelligent design, number one, does not rule out any kind of cause in advance. It says, let's look at the evidence.
Yes.
Wow, what a novel idea.
Yeah. Exactly.
You think that we would actually let science look at the evidence and not use philosophy to shove some of the possibilities into the trash can before the first piece of evidence laid down? That is really a good move for science. But anyway, I'm getting very editorializing. If I break into too much editorializing, just rein me in. Pull back on my reins. But seriously, intelligent design is, I like to describe it or define it this way. It's the study of patterns in nature that are best explained by an intelligent cause.
Hmm.
It's the study of patterns in nature. You might even say the study of phenomena. Okay, it's the plural of phenomenon, but you know, things that we see, objects, systems, molecular machines,
yes,
ecological networks, anything, could be anything physical that we can observe with our eyes and ears or an extension of our senses. And so the study are these patterns in nature, these phenomena, and looking at what can be discerned, what you can conclude as to the best explanation. And so we believe that some phenomena can be explained by natural causes, and when we have a natural cause that fits well, that's good. We know it's caused by this, you know, nudge over here, or that, you know, branch, you know, broke through the window. Well, was the branch already seen tapping on the window before the big wind came up? Then probably it was not put through the window by a bad little boy.
Right.
See?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if the branch is located, you know, say 100 yards away from the window, and if we see that the branch was severed by a little saw, we can see the saw marks, and we can see the fingerprint of the bad little boy on one end of the branch, as he kind of left his, let's say, peanut butter impression, fingerprint,
mm-hmm,
on the branch, then we know. We have the data. We know it was intelligently caused.
Yes.
That's a crude illustration, but I often will compare the Man in the Mountain formation in New Hampshire, which is sadly now collapsed, but it's still on the license plate for the New Hampshire cars.
Yes.
That Man in the Mountain was a formation that vaguely, to the eye, you might say, of faith, or to the eye looking from one angle, looked a little bit like a chiseled man. It didn't look like that way if you came a couple hundred yards to the left. So that formation can be formed by erosion. But if you go over to South Dakota and come to another mountain called Mount Rushmore, those four men in the mountain were not and could not plausibly have been formed by random patterns of erosion, right, whether rain or whatever.
Yes.
And so whenever you talk about intelligent design, you don't have to consult any holy book. I love scripture. I teach it in my school and in my church. But intelligent design has the advantage of not being, you know, based on the authority of some revelation. It's based on inference of data which is staring you in the face. And so anybody of any religious tradition can consider it. And there are even some celebrated open-minded agnostics that are active in the intelligent design movement.
Yeah. And that that was a very important statement that that you made there, Tom. And for some of our listeners, that may seem a bit counterintuitive, especially when I make this statement. But discussing intelligent design and what we find in nature and allowing the evidence to take us wherever it does is a powerful tool to actually use in evangelism. Now, I've seen people look at me strangely when I've mentioned this before, but you can actually witness and share God's creation and the magnificence of it and never even open the scriptures. You can talk to them about nature and what we find and the complexity and so on and so forth. So I think it lends itself well, intelligent design as a field of inquiry, lends itself well to evangelism efforts, especially when you're reaching out to folks who are perhaps philosophically or scientifically inclined. I wonder if we could jump and talk, Tom, about some of the folks that that you cover, some of the prominent scientists and authors. Now, you've written extensively about these authors. I'm just going to give you some names. And then if you would give us a synopsis of these people, what their expertise is, where they work, and what contributions they've made to the field of intelligent design. And I'd like to start with Michael Denton.
Sure. Yeah, he really kicked off the movement 30 years ago, exactly 30 years ago. He wrote out a book after much struggle to find the right publisher. Burnett Books, Hutchinson, which owns, I guess, this company, Burnett Books in England, brought out Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. And this book, I just put an ETIC, which stands for Evolution, and it has a colon, A Theory in Crisis, is a book that is unusual in that it was like a cry in the middle of a midnight darkness. Okay, it's like a shock of a bomb going off.
Yeah.
And the name of my dissertation, when I wrote up the history of intelligent design, I actually used a phrase that comes from philosophy. It's called "aroused from dogmatic slumber." Mm-hmm. In other words, people are asleep,
yeah,
with the teaching that everything came from chance and evolution is true, and you're almost like lulled into this sleepiness.
Yes.
By the clock or the watch being, you know, going back and forth, held by, you know, the hypnotist. And all of a sudden, snap, you realize, wait a minute, as you read Michael Denton's book, whether you're a Christian or an atheist,
yeah,
since he was an agnostic when he wrote the book,
mm-hmm,
he doesn't have any kind of axe to grind for,
right,
Genesis or God or creation in general. He's basically analyzing and meticulously pulling apart, you might say dismantling, the entire theory of macroevolution.
Mm-hmm.
From one end to the other. And after analyzing 12 lines of evidence, you've realized microevolution, which is trivial, that's never been in doubt,
yeah,
is of course true. But macro, the real theory, the heart, the beating,
yes,
heart of the theory,
yeah,
is completely gone.
Yes.
Has never been supported in the evidence. And you're,
yeah,
thinking, whoa,
yeah,
how could I have believed this all along?
Mm-hmm.
When this brilliant molecular biologist, Michael Denton, has literally torn the thing just apart. Yeah, at the end of the book, he says, the Darwinian theory of evolution is neither more nor less than the great cosmogenic myth, M-Y-T-H, myth of the 20th century.
Mm.
Of course, published in 85 and 86, and in America came out a year later. And you're thinking, at that point, it's not such a, it's still a shocking conclusion, but you realize why he says it.
Yeah.
And you're nodding in agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll never forget, when I received the book, we were actually having a missionary work in Dominican Republic, and I got the book, and for about 2 weeks, as I read a chapter a day, I was having my devotions. I think it was some New Testament book I was reading. And then I would go from the sunroom at the front of our apartment, Santo Domingo, I would go to my office in the back, and I would have my second devotions
mm-hmm.
by reading a chapter of Michael Denton.
Yeah. Powerful.
And so he started the ball rolling, and mm-hmm. that laid the foundation for the entire critique and for people to criticize and offer a replacement theory without even getting into the Genesis issues.
Yes. Yeah. Philip Johnson.
Okay. So Michael Denton started the ball rolling, but he was not eager to really do much with it. Philip Johnson, formerly a hardcore agnostic, verging on atheist, law professor at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
not exactly known as a haven of conservatism on the West Coast.
Right.
Not exactly Bob Jones West.
Right.
So he was, after he came to faith in a Christian God, to the Creator, in a general way, he was still an evolutionist for a number of years, much like C.S. Lewis was for a while. And then he stumbled when he was on his sabbatical in London. He stumbled across Denton's book, finished it in 2 weeks, less than that, 2 days, and read another book by Richard Dawkins, The Blind Watchmaker, and he realized that the two of them were diametrically opposed, but only Denton was really getting into the evidence.
Yes.
Dawkins was just using clever rhetoric, brilliant repartee with words, and just this enormous absence of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so Johnson pulled together, and I had the privilege of introducing him to another group of scientists who were already working on these issues, and it was kind of, you might say, intellectual love at first sight. And,
yes.
the group congealed or bonded, and immediately they elected Johnson without even having to vote as their leader. And he, with his brilliance of a C.S. Lewis, a modern-day C.S. Lewis, Johnson jumped into the fray and began to organize the entire sophisticated questioning of Darwinism and what became, by 1996, the intelligent design movement.
Mm-hmm.
So his book, Darwin on Trial, Reason in the Balance, and three other books really spearheaded the movement in the opening 10 years.
Yes. Yeah. And then Michael Behe.
Oh, my goodness. Now the dam breaks.
Yes.
This is where it goes. If I were a Darwinist, I would say, let's change the subject.
Right. Yes.
They cannot get their hands around Michael Behe. And, of course, it is spelled B-E-H-E.
Yes.
Household word now, if you know anything about this area. Whereas Darwin, of course, was himself trained in theology at Cambridge, never an actual degreed naturalist. Johnson was sort of like that, trained in law, and through his own reading and study became a naturalist, Philip Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
But Behe was the real McCoy.
Yeah.
PhD in molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
Discoverer of a form of DNA called Z-DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Really amazing guy. Funny as the day is long. He could almost be, your, night show, Jimmy O'Fallon, whatever the guy's name.
Yeah.
This would be a good replacement. He is such a quick-witted guy.
Mm-hmm.
But when he read, again, when Michael Behe, in 87, I think it was, read Michael Denton's book,
mm-hmm.
Evolution of Theory in Crisis, same thing with Phil Johnson, it, within 24 hours, turned him 180 degrees from a casual believer in Darwin's theory to an upset, riled up, why didn't anybody tell me any of these things?
Mm-hmm.
The skeptic of Darwin's theory. And then he began his own research. He joined the group. I had, again, just a delightful opportunity to see Behe join the group. I was there taking notes as all these people met. And so when 1996, when Behe dropped his H-bomb, we're moving from the A-bomb now to the H-bomb.
Yes.
That even the New York Times took note of, in a positive way. Now, that's a shocker.
That is a shocker.
The New York Times published a positive review of Michael Behe's magisterial book, voted one of the top 100 most influential books of the 20th century, Darwin's Black Box.
Yes.
And I would say, to this day, it is the single most powerful book advocating intelligent design ever written,
mm-hmm.
even now, almost 20 years after its release. And so Michael Behe's book stands head over shoulders as the one that has now permanently changed the discussion because of his exposition of the watch-like character, the machine-like character, the mousetrap-like character.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that later, maybe.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to that. But first, I'd like to mention the fourth and final, and that is William Dembski.
Oh, yes. Every movement needs its wonk. You know, it's genius.
Yeah.
It's Albert Einstein, right?
Yeah. All right.
Where would we be without the theory of relativity? Where would we be without Bill Dembski's explanatory filter?
Yes.
So enters now probably a guy who, if he was measured on the IQ scale, might be pushing 200.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told that 140 is like very, very gifted. You know,
mm-hmm.
hey, maybe you can think about applying to Ivy League schools.
Yeah.
His genius is just shocking. Okay, so Bill Dembski practically skips through all of the schooling. His dad's a professor. You know, go to the top of the class. He gets his PhD in mathematics and statistical analysis from the prestigious University of Chicago. And then, as if that wasn't enough, he goes to Princeton Seminary and gets a master in divinity and theology, defends the conservative biblical point of view there. That's where I first met him on the Princeton campus when we were doing some events. And then he goes back to Illinois and gets another PhD in the philosophy of science.
Oh, boy.
University of Illinois at Chicago. Anyway, so he develops an explanatory filter, which is the way you can absolutely mathematically and using rigorous analysis of the evidence test and see if an intelligent agent has caused a certain object or phenomenon or whether it can be explained by just pure dumb luck working on physical natural systems. And his explanatory filter, I think, is one of the genius ideas of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never been proved wrong. It's rigorously applied. It is fantastic. And it's one of the backbone truths of the intelligent design movement.
Yeah.
And again, maybe we can unpack that. Maybe it takes 10 seconds to do that later.
Yeah. Well, I would like to touch on Behe's irreducible complexity. So that our listeners can grasp the power of this. Now, you mentioned the mousetrap, and that's the one that I see most often as a model of exactly what this means. So could you walk our listeners through what that means, Tom, irreducible complexity?
And again, if I can just say that you might even just say that means the same thing as a watch-like or even a mousetrap-like complexity.
Yes.
Which involves many interacting physical parts.
Yes.
The best video, and I'll just sort of touch again on the video resource.
Yes.
Or resources. But the best video for this concept is that first one, Unlocking the Mystery of Life. Because the second 15-minute segment of that video is all about Michael Behe and his ideas. Now, it brings in a number of other people. Scott Minnick, a creation friendly, intelligent design guy at a university in Idaho. He's featured because he's one of the world's leading experts on a little gizmo called the flagellum. It's an outboard motor, a propeller system on the back end of a bacteria. It has 40 working parts meshing together.
Yeah.
But to get back to the irreducible, and that's a big word, but irreducible with two R's, complexity, which means a complexity that you can't reduce further and still have function.
Yes.
And so he uses the mousetrap as the classic example. And I've actually taken, to many of my lectures, a great big rat trap. You know, one of these guys is about 8 inches long, or almost a foot long, and I hold it up and I flap it around so you can see the little, the parts wiggling. And I try to very carefully set it and then spring it, and it makes a loud, of course, scary crack. You know, when it is triggered and then released. So the mouse trap has five parts. It has the base. It has the U-shaped hammer, the one that actually does the execution of the little critter. It has a powerful spring that gives it that power to snap. It has the holding bar that holds it back, and of course that holding bar fits in a clever little catch, a little trigger mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that's leaving out the staples that hold the thing down, but if you include those, there's maybe 7. But anyway, I'm leaving the peanut butter or cheese out.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, if you have any one of those 5 parts missing, you don't have a less effective mousetrap. You don't have just less ability to catch mice. You don't catch any mice.
That's right, yeah.
So you have to have all 5 parts. So a mousetrap is irreducible. You cannot get rid of any one of the parts.
Right.
Now, the problem this poses for Darwin is that Darwin says, right there in his book, if it could be demonstrated that any organ or organism exists which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications. In other words, if you can show me a gizmo in a living animal or plant which has many parts, all of which are necessary, in other words, which you cannot just keep adding another part and it gets a little bit better, add another part and it gets a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
If you find a gizmo or system which requires all the parts to be there and you cannot develop it gradually, my theory would absolutely, this is Darwin's words,
yes,
my theory would absolutely break down.
Yes.
I'm glad he said that.
Mm-hmm.
Because Michael Behe, you know, almost 150 years later, 140 some years later, said, "Thank you, Charles Darwin. I will take your wager,
right.
And I will show now that your theory has absolutely broken down inside the cell."
Yes.
Because the cell isn't just, you know, populated by a few, 2 or 3. It is chock full with machines, systems of breathtaking and exquisite complexity.
Yes.
Whose formation no Darwinist in the world has even come up with a way to even imagine the step-by-step development of it.
Yeah.
This applies to blood clotting, for example, which requires 20 different proteins, each of them different, each of them exquisitely lock and key fit to the one next to it to trigger it and modulate it so that the first one detects the, you know, the oxygen, which triggers the second, which wakes up the third, which sets in motion the fourth,
mm-hmm.
which works on the fifth to get it working, and so forth and so on, until the 20th protein finally sets up the mesh, the basement for the clot itself.
Yes.
And I say, when I read about that, more like 20 years ago, I just said, wow, I had no idea that even the blood clotting system was so amazingly complex as that.
Yeah.
So that's one of the chapters in his book, which has, I think, about 15 major examples of discoveries. And since his book came out in 1996, not a single one of those systems has had any successful experimental testing or verification of even a possible route through which it could have been evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this just thundering silence.
Yes.
When you ask scientists, how did these systems, these irreducibly complex systems, arise? They just shrug their shoulders, and some of them say, well, let's talk about Noah's Ark. They try to change the subject, in other words.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, you know the answer to that already, and our listeners do as well. They are wedded to their system philosophically, and of course that doesn't... Yeah, yeah.
Their religion trumps evidence. Religious preference trumps any serious inquiry at that point.
Yes. Tom, before we get into some brief explanations of some of the criticisms of intelligent design that, in my opinion, fall well short of being valid in any sense of debate, I'm wondering if you could touch on Dembski's explanatory filter and just explain what that is.
Well, sure. And again, if I can go back to the reality of that formation out in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the Mount Rushmore carving or sculpting, I guess I should use that word, of the 4 presidential faces, that has a low probability of being formed by erosion. I mean, no scientist in the world, no expert on geology would deny that. You know, the standard formation is all formed vertical rivulets not, you know, carved faces. And we see that over and over. Never has an exception been seen. So it's not just the low probability. And Densky shows why if you set it really, 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 really low, that's one part in 10 with 150 zeros after it.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So this is called the, it has a statistical or mathematical name. The term is the universal probability bound, like the boundary. It's like you will never go past this and find something that is this rare producing or mimicking intelligent stuff, intelligent-looking stuff, okay?
Yeah.
So it has to be less, you know, and this can be figured out pretty readily, just using physical analysis and a little basic statistics. If an object or event or a phenomenon has a lower probability than one part out of 10 to the 150th power, then you look to see if, secondly, if that pattern, phenomenon, event, machine, whatever, is conforming to an ideal or independent pattern. In other words, if you just say, wow, that looks like a cool pattern, you draw a circle around it, that doesn't catch. You have to have the circle drawn ahead of time. And then, if the match is, for example, if I were to photograph you walking into the studio as we're doing this interview.
Yeah.
And then if I were to take a photograph, let's say a video, hidden video camera, and then I show the exact location, and I say, well, that's a low probability event, and yet it happened. That's right. But what if I actually, if I showed you where 2 weeks ago I already laid out exactly where you would walk to the within a millimeter, within a tenth of a millimeter, and then you wound up walking by that same pattern, and we compared my prophecy, you know, my little written pattern of your feet,
mm-hmm.
with the actual pattern that the video shows that you use, then people would be, well, how did you know that?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that's an independent pattern.
Yeah.
So, I know this is maybe a little bit tough to grab on the first hearing, but I would say, again, unlocking the mystery of life as a whole, about 5 to 10 minutes, near the end, where they show hieroglyphics and they show sculpted bushes at a theme park, and they show, you know, all kinds of other data in a computer screen. All things that are arranged in a unique way for a purpose, for a plan, for an ideal setup. If you have both low probability and an independent ideal pattern that it conforms to, boom. You know that it's been designed.
Yes.
You can detect intelligence, and we do this every day.
Yeah.
I mean, if I
yeah.
look at a series of letters on the wall, I don't say, boy, somebody had a really interesting brush of black paint that just by random scrunching against the wall painted those letters. No.
Yeah, right.
You know, a streak would make a little horizontal pattern that looks like random.
Mm-hmm.
But letters, obviously, somebody sat there. I don't know who. And again, intelligent design doesn't necessarily tell you the who. It just tells you that an intelligent agent did it.
Yes. Yeah. Those are just some of the very powerful illustrations, examples, evidence, and principles that Christians can use when they're talking to folks who are really in bondage to Darwinian evolutionary theory. I'm wondering, Tom, if in what time we have left, if we could equip our listeners to answer. Yeah, yeah. I'd like to equip them briefly, if we could, with some of the answers to objections that they're going to
sure.
hear. For example, someone who's wedded to evolutionary theory might say, well, intelligent design is not science. How would you answer that?
This is heard all the time.
Yeah.
And I would just ask the person, well, according to what standard of science?
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
I would just turn it right around.
Yeah.
If they just mouth the general thing, you know, it's practiced by scientists like Michael Behe.
Yes.
And there's 700 scientists, actually it's 900 scientists who have voted with their laptop or their computer and gone online and signed the dissent from Darwinism list.
Yes, yes.
Almost 1,000 scientists were up to with masters, most of them with PhDs. in their respective fields. They are doubting the theory, and the vast majority of those are doing work or research, even bench research, demonstrating that intelligent design is a fruitful idea, and it has been working very well for 20-some years, even before Michael Beaton.
Yeah. How about this one? Intelligent design is nothing more than dressed-up creationism.
Again, that's a variation. Someone says, a professor, I think, or maybe a museum official in Kansas said it's like creationism in a cheap tuxedo.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to go out and buy a cheap tuxedo.
Yeah.
So the idea of dressed-up creationism is interesting. I mean, there obviously are some overlapping doubts about Darwinian theory, mm-hmm. is one aspect. But, you know, creationism is usually affiliated with a literal reading of Genesis. I happen to take Genesis as a historical sketch. I don't mm-hmm. matter if, you know, turn it into metaphor or poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very minimalistic sketch. God just doesn't feel it's necessary to give a lot of the details
mm-hmm.
of how he set up the world in a rapid succession, and these ecological networks need to be set up quickly and together. And so I think the Genesis is important, but again, intelligent design is minimalistic. It carries light baggage. It hardly even takes more than maybe just a duffel bag or a backpack, whereas creationism, on purpose, is trying to let's say, fit together scientific data and theories with a straightforward reading of Genesis, let's say.
Yeah.
Now, the two of those can be embraced by the same person. I would be an example.
Mm-hmm.
A certain form of, you know, creation scientific belief.
Yeah.
But that would not be required by the theory of intelligent design. There's no relationship between the two
mm-hmm.
in terms of necessity that one implies the other.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, last one. Intelligent design does no meaningful research and publishes nothing that's peer-reviewed.
Well, that's just an absolute misrepresentation of facts.
Yeah.
That is an absolutely and grossly ignorant statement. It was 10, 15 years ago. It's
yeah.
overwhelmingly false now. I mean, anybody who goes and Googles peer-reviewed research and intelligent design and Discovery Institute will see lists that are published, I think, just about every year by Discovery Institute. Can I just go ahead and mention the best source on this area, or
yes.
any area, of the Darwin design conflict is the news blog that literally has anywhere from 2 to 5 articles every day, and that's evolutionnews.org. Evolutionnews.org, along with another news blog, a news service called crev.info, that's crev.info. Crev.info, done by David Coppedge, but also the mama, the big one, is evolutionnews.org. You will just go back any month over the last, let's say, 15, 18 years that they've been keeping a record. They have warehoused or archived articles.
Yes.
They're fantastic. You would get an entire PhD in intelligent design just by reading a couple hundred of those articles.
Excellent, excellent.
At least a PhD from me.
That's right. Okay. Well, I want to encourage our listeners to go out to the C.S. Lewis Society site, check out the resources there, but also check out these DVDs, Unlocking the Mysteries of Life, The Privileged Planet, and Darwin's Dilemma. You get a real education in intelligent design. Any new projects you're working on, Tom, you want to share with our listeners?
Well, I would just say that, you know, the newer series, which just was completed about a month and a half ago, includes Metamorphosis, Beauty and Design of Butterflies, and the second one in the newer series is called Flight, The Genius of Birds, and the one that just came out recently is Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth. So Metamorphosis, Living Waters are mandatory watching, at least to get to that master's degree level.
Yes.
On our project, we're trying to, you know, come out with some things on DNA and epigenetics. I hope to lead DNA seminars and train up other people to help with me lead these DNA seminars in metro cities across the country. And so maybe we can come to someplace in Ohio, maybe even your city.
That would be wonderful. We'll chat about that and see if we can't make that happen. Tom, I appreciate your time. Thank you for joining me on Soaring Eagle Radio.
It's been a privilege and a delight to be with you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. God bless you. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.